give some of the background of this. So this is part of a project. There's been a lot of talk recently about whether we should take quantum wave functions or quantum states to be part of represent part of our ontology or something else. And that's not what this talk is about. The talk is about, among people who want to be realist about quantum states and wave functions, it comes from me thinking about the question, well, is there a viable, could we have a viable picture of the world in which that's everything there is? And I've been spending time recently talking with Bohmians who want to vehemently deny that. And what I want to talk about is something that is sometimes regarded as an obstacle to that sort of thing, which I think is kind of misguided. And I think if you try to explain why it's misguided, it leads to insight as, well, how should we think of quantum wave functions, which is the positive talk. So I'm going to start with a few quotes from well-known philosophers, quotes that I think are just totally nuts. But these are very smart quote. They're going to be a quote from David Albert and Barry Lower and Tim Maudlin. But these are very smart people, and I want to explain why I think what they're saying is completely nuts. And by the way, for those of you who are not philosophers, you might know, David Albert is at Columbia University in New York. Barry Lower is at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Tim Maudlin was recently at Rutgers and is now at NYU. So you could think of motivation of this talk is that area of the country hasn't gotten enough bashing recently, and I'm going to do a little bit more. Okay. All right. A little bit of background. When did people start talking about wave functions? And I think not everyone realizes this, but when Schrödinger first wrote down what we now know as the Schrödinger equation, he was thinking in the context of de Broglie's pilot wave theory. And the picture there, for those who aren't familiar, is that their particles are kind of like classical particles, but they don't behave classically in that they've got these pilot waves that push them around. And Schrödinger wanted to write down a wave equation for de Broglie's pilot wave. Then Schrödinger made an odd move. He said, well, let's have a theory that has nothing but the pilot waves and leaves out the particles. And this is what he called wave mechanics. And this is the Schrödinger wave mechanics that we all learn in our intro courses. In 1951, Bohm took Schrödinger's wave equation and put the particles back and ended up with pretty much exactly the same theory that de Broglie presented in 1927 at the Fifth Solvay Conference. And Bohm didn't at first realize that he was basically reinventing the wheel, but that was pointed out to him. And the original idea behind this pilot wave is that it was going to be a new kind of field analogous to electromagnetic fields. In fact, de Broglie's hope was that the pilot wave that guided photons around would be electromagnetic fields. It was quickly realized that it couldn't be that simple, because there's a hitch, is that for the Schrödinger wave function, if I have n particles, the wave function is a function not on ordinary three-dimensional space, but on a three n-dimensional configuration space. So that's one clue that it's not like an ordinary field. And de Broglie thought, Bohm's attitude is that he wanted to develop a theory in which each particle had its own guiding field. And so, and for precisely that reason, he thought of the theory that he presented at Solvay Conference in 1927 as a provisional step towards a better theory. Okay. Now, if you want to think of the wave function as a field, one thing you can do is bite the bullet and say, well, it is kind of like ordinary fields, except we just have to accept a unfamiliar space. And here's David Auer, who has very strong teeth, biting the bullet. According to him, the lesson to be learned from quantum mechanics is that the space we live in, the space in which any realistic understanding of quantum mechanics is necessarily going to depict the history of the world as playing itself out as configuration space. And whatever impression we have to the contrary, whatever impression we have, say, of living in a three-dimensional space or in a four-dimensional space-time, is somehow flatly illusory. Here's Barry Lower, writing at more or less the same time. They're friends, they hang out, they talk. We can think of the manifest world, the world of macroscopic objects and their motions, as shadows cast by the quantum state and the world particle as they evolve in configuration space. If Bohm's theory, or any other version of quantum mechanics that construes the wave function realistically, is correct, then that space that we live in is configuration space. And this is from an article called Humean Supervenience. That's a term that will be familiar to the philosophers in the room and unfamiliar to the physicists in the room, probably. That's a term due to the philosopher David Lewis. And the picture is that all there is to the world is a compendium of local matters of particular fact, and everything else, including the laws of nature, supervene on those. And Lewis was committed to it being local matters of particular fact. And that fits very poorly with quantum mechanical wave functions. Unless you think the base space is configuration space, in which case they can be, you know, local matters of fact about regions in configuration space. So this is part of Barry Lower's motivation for saying things like this in this paper. And here's Tim Modlin more recently. This is actually the thing that got me thinking about this. This is a talk that he gave in Oxford in 2007, which is published at a Many Worlds conference. It was published in a volume that came from that conference entitled Many Worlds. Any theory whose physical ontology is a complete wave function monism automatically inherits a severe interpretational problem. If all there is the wave function, an extremely high dimensional object involving in some specified way, how does that account for the low dimensional world of localized objects that we start out believing in, whose apparent behavior constitutes the explanandum of physics in the first place? So he thinks that I've got this interpretational problem that people like David and Albert are going to try to solve to explain why we have this illusion that we're living in a four-dimensional space-time. Modlin's own view is that we shouldn't have a wave function monism because we talk about configuration space. But if all there is a wave function without any de Broglie-Bohm particles, raises the worry about what those, do we even get to call this a configuration space? Isn't it just some abstract 3N dimensional space if there's nothing for the configurations to be configurations of? And if I just give you, so here's the picture I think Tim Modlin has. I just give you a theory. And I say for a system of, spinless quantum systems with 3N degrees of freedom, there's this function defined on a 3N dimensional space, and I don't tell you anything about its relation to space-time. Interpret that as making sense about the world. I think that's the picture he has. My attitude is this, that when people start saying things like that, something fairly serious has gone wrong. And I think something goes wrong at the very beginning of the chain of reasoning that leads David Albert and Barry Lower and Tim Modlin to say things like that. And I think what I want to do, and I think I make a case that if you think about what wave functions are in the right way, you aren't going to be tempted to say things like that. So I want to argue that on a proper understanding of a quantum wave function, Well, there's no reason whatsoever to think of configuration space as more fundamental than ordinary space-time. Even on a quantum state monist ontology, there's no problem of this. Modelings worry that configuration space is somehow going to come unstuck from space-time, has no foundation, no reason to worry. And here's something that I think is one of the more important lessons. Even when I have a single particle wave function, which looks like it's an ordinary, which we like to think of as a fairly ordinary field on space-time, what I want to say is that we should not think of it that way. I can think of the value of electromagnetic field at a certain point as being a local property of that point, meaning that I can regard as intrinsic to a small region surrounding that point and attributing an electromagnetic field to a point doesn't carry any implication, isn't implicitly a statement about things in the rest of the universe. I want to say that even when you have a single particle wave function, which looks like a field on space-time, that's the wrong way to think about it. Okay. All right. And as out of historical interest, think of it this way, sheds light, I think. Sorry, this is a sentence that originally said has relevance to, and then turned into sheds light on, and apparently didn't get completely corrected. Okay, shed lights on or has relevance for EPR type arguments, and helps us see Einstein's remarks during the general discussion at the end of the 1927 conference, which were transcribed and published, and recently translated into English in a volume by. Translated by Guido Bacigalupi and Anthony Valentini, helps us see those remarks as actually a precursor to the EPR type arguments and the later arguments that Einstein gave about quantum mechanics. And if time, that I probably won't do at the PSA, but if I have time today, I'll do that. Okay. And how am I going to argue for this? Well, my argument is going to be guided by a principle that I think we ought to bear in mind anytime we're talking about the ontology of a physical theory, drawing ontological lessons from a physical theory, is that we're fairly certain that pretty much any of our current physical theories aren't the final story. Physics has not come to an end. And we should be open to the idea that whatever we have now is going to come out at, emerge as some kind of approximation and some kind of limit for something deeper and more fundamental. And we should bear that in mind when we're trying to draw ontological conclusions from the theory. And in the case of quantum mechanics, we don't have to conjecture about a more fundamental theory because we think of quantum mechanics as emerging as some kind of low energy, non-relativistic limit from a quantum field theory. And what I want to do is talk about how you can get wave functions from a low energy, non-relativistic limit of a quantum field theory, something that's either not done in your standard quantum field theory textbooks or passed over fairly briefly. And the reason I want to do that is that I think that the way that comes about has important ramifications for how we think of wave functions. Okay. The way I'm going to do it is I'm going to start with relativistic quantum field theory. Take a non-relativistic limit and get a Galilean invariant quantum field theory, and then get quantum mechanics from that. Okay, and I'm going to take the easiest case: free field, Klein-Gordon field. So, suppose you've got field operators. Fnatic people in the audience want me to say those aren't really operators, they're operator value distributions. So field operators when smealed by test functions, but I'm going to follow the textbooks and say field operators, and you'll know what I mean. So suppose we have field operators satisfying the Klein-Gordon equation. We can decompose these in terms of these operators. They should be familiar to some of them. Some of you, this B dagger is meant to be a creation. So this A is a annihilation A operator for particles with momentum, energy momentum K, and the B dagger is a creation operator for antiparticles with energy momentum K, and omega K is that. What I want to do, since I want to get, I'm going to go to a non-relativistic quantum field theory. First thing I'm going to do is abandon Lorentz invariant and pick a particular reference frame. And what really counts is I'm picking a particular time slicing of space-time. And it's easiest to do it with flat hypersurfaces. You could do it with another foliation if you wanted to. And define these operators in terms of those AKs that I had before. And the important thing is that these are defined as they are with reference to a particular choice of a time coordinate. NW is for Newton-Wigner. If you know the commutations of the AKs, then you can figure out the commutation relations of these. And what you get is that the equal time commutation relations is they commute, these things commute for different Xs, which is, if you want to think, the idea is you want to think of this guy, the phi dagger, as a creation operator for a particle localized at a point x at time t on that hypersurface. And Newton and Wigner actually showed that Galilean invariants on that hypersurface actually uniquely determines the form of these. There's debate in the literature about whether we should take a Newton-Wigner state as actually precisely localized as a point or something smeared out on the order of the Compton wavelength. Since I'm going to take a non-relativistic limit, I get to totally ignore those things. So, all right. And now I can. Do is take these guys and separate, form something like that, form that by separating out, if I want a Galilean theory, what I want to do is say, well, the energy is going to be rest mass plus kinetic energy, and in the non-relativistic limit, I want to pull out the rest mass and not call it part of the energy. So, you do that. And this part, I think, is familiar to many people, is that then, if this thing satisfies a Klein-Gordon equation, you apply a Klein-Gordon equation to this, and you get something that is Schrödinger equation plus a 1 over c squared term, which I say in the non-relativistic limit when, I take c to infinity. Turns into a Schrödinger equation. Okay. Now, if I want to, so if I take a vacuum state and hit it with one of these Newton-Wigner operators, then I get a state which has one particle localized at x. And if I want a general one particle state, then you superpose these. So any state that's a one particle state on the t equals zero hypersurface is going to be represented by this with this for some function psi. These are just coefficients of expansions in terms of of that state, in terms of the Newton-Wigner localized state, or actually, if I've already taken the, I think I've already taken the relativistic limits, so I can think of these in my Galilean context as operators that create a particle at a point. And given that kind of state, this that function will give the probability density for finding a single particle, and that function will obey the Schrodinger equation, and I've gotten my one particle quantum mechanics from my quantum field theory by specializing to a very special class of states, the ones that are one particle states. And actually, this will be conserved, so if it's a one particle state on one hypersurface, it'll be forever a one particle state. And that I can actually get for my relativistic theory for a particular foliation. I can say something is forever a one particle state if it, you know, we mean one particle state on one time slice and a one particle state on every time slice bound that foliation. But it's not going to be a one particle state for arbitrary time slices, space like hyperplanes. You know, there's going to be some probability of getting more than one. If I look at another space like hyperplane, there's going to be a probability of getting more than one particle on that one. So the idea of being a single particle state is actually a non-relativistic notion. Or if there's sort of particles that can talk that I can localize, that's and notice that this wave function is defined only for a special class of states, namely the ones that are one particle states with respect to a particular function. In particular states, they're satisfying some, you know, this global property that if I do a particle detection measurement over here and one over there, I'll never get both detectors firing. And if I do it all over the all over space at once, I'll get at least one of those detectors firing. Now that's a global property of the state. Okay. Given that, there's just no way this function is a local variable. I can't even it make sense of it unless I think my quantum state is one of these special states satisfying this global property. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't even make sense to talk about psi unless I've got a state satisfying that. So that's why I want to say that this psi cannot be thought of as a local variable or an intrinsic attribute of arbitrary small neighborhoods of that of a point in space-time. Okay. And of course I'm going to say similar things for two particle states. There's going to be a function of two variables, which is the expansion coefficients for arbitrary two particle states, and you know, say the similar things and same thing for n particle states. So if I, you know, if I want to look at the subspace of states that are n particle states on some hypersurface, then those are going to be indexed by these functions with n arguments, which could be defined by that. Okay. So what we've done is we started with a quantum field theory defined on ordinarily Minkowski spacetime. We started with these field operators, which are defined on spacetime. And what we've done is we've picked out a particular class of states and used that to construct a 3n-dimensional configuration space. And that's what I just said. If you think of it that way, I think it alleviates, or at least I hope it does, the worry that somehow or another configuration space is more fundamental. Configuration space is something that arises out of a more fundamental theory for a special class of states in a non-relativistic limit. And you know, I define, I started with ordinary space-time and the relationship between these wave functions and ordinary space-time is manifest in the way it arises. So, these wave functions are basically, and part of the wave function is defined as a function that gives you probability density for particle detections of these locations of these n particles, and these are locations of the n particles in ordinary space on that on a particular hypersurface. And a single particle wave function, which we were tempted to originally to think of as being analogous to a field on space, as I said a moment ago, it requires global conditions of the state for it to actually make sense, and because what it is, it's the coefficient of expansion that should be a dagger. Expand your state, your state in terms of these localized states, which have a particle localized at one point. This psi of x is that coefficient expansion, and these states, they're localized states, but they're localized in the states that, in the sense that they satisfy the condition that there's a particle x and nowhere else. And that's saying something not just about that point x, but saying something about all of space. Okay. So I've already said this, but I just want to reiterate, it can't be regarded as an intrinsic property of a small neighborhood of the point. It's not that. Okay. Well, actually doing pretty good in terms of time. Actually, that was like pretty much 20 minutes, and that could be my PSA talk, eh? Okay, so now here's the part that I won't have time to do a PSA. I think that this has relevance to EPR-type arguments. So this is basically not EPR or Einstein's terminology, but my reconstruction of these kinds of arguments. Assume the condition of separability. That's a condition that Einstein eventually explicitly acknowledged as a premise to these arguments. It comes out clearest in a paper published in the Journal Dialectica in 1948. And the idea is that everything there is to the world can be described as a compendium of matters of description of properties to small regions or maybe to points. Physicists probably don't know the word supervenience or supervenient. When I say that all beables supervene on local beables, what I mean is, if you tell me what all the local beables are, then that's enough for you to figure out what everything is, so that anything there else is definable in terms of the local beables, or it's wholly determined by them. Assume locality, which is the principle that local beables at one location can't be instantaneously affected by actions in another location. And if you make those assumptions, and I think that this is implicit in Einstein's argument, quantum state of something, if it's an actual quantic state, by separability has to be a local property, and by locality can't be affected by operations of others. But when I have two entangled systems, my choice of measurement on one system affects the state attributed to the other. Einstein always expressed this as an argument for the incompleteness of the quantum state description. And Kerrigan and Speckens have recently pointed out that the argument works equally well as an argument for not having the quantum state being part of your ontology at all. If you make these assumptions, if you make these assumptions. Now, there's a particular mythology about the Einstein-Bohr discussions or Einstein's discussions about quantum mechanics. And the mythology goes that Einstein never really accepted quantum mechanics and that he went through a phase where he was trying to defeat the uncertainty relations. And then in 1935, when the EPR paper was published, it was a shift of tactics because he no longer thought that he could come up with experiments in which you could know more about the state of the system than quantum mechanics allows, but was only trying to argue for the incompleteness of quantum mechanics. Now, the interesting thing about that mythology is that there's no record in public transcripts of discussions or Einstein's published works or Einstein's private papers or Einstein's letters to anyone of any attempt by Einstein to defeat the uncertainty relations. The account that he was doing that comes primarily from Bohr in his famous paper, Discussions with Einstein on Epistemological Issues and Quantum Mechanics or something like that, in the volume Einstein, Philosopher Scientist, and from letters from people sympathetic to Bohr, such as Paul Ehrenfest. But there's also a letter from Paul Ehrenfest where he's writing to Bohr, where he says, "You know, I've just talked more with Einstein, and I think we misunderstood Einstein last time we were talking to him. He wasn't trying to defeat the uncertainty relations." And so I actually wonder whether that was simply a misunderstanding on the part of Bohr and his sympathizers. If you think it's an uncharitable interpretation to say that perhaps Bohr misunderstood Einstein, take a look at the transcripts of discussion at the 1927 Solvay argument. Solvay conference, because after the argument that I'm about to talk about, a few people speak, and then Bohr speaks, and the first thing he says is, "I don't think I understand what Einstein was getting at." So here's the argument that he gave at the Solvay conference in 1927 during the discussion. And similar things occur in various letters to people. If psi squared were simply regarded as the probability that at a certain point a given particle is found at a given time, it could happen that the same elementary process produces an action in two or several places on the screen. So you know, if it's just the probability that you're going to get a particle here on the screen, and you think of that, I think he's implicitly thinking about that as sort of a local property of that point of space-time, then there should be independent probabilities at each point of the screen, and there could be a certain probability of getting two or more. But the interpretation according to which psi squared addresses the probability that this particle is found at a given point assumes, and I think the difference is, versus the probability that you will get a particle, some particle there, versus the probability I can talk about one particular particle, talk about where it is, assumes an entirely peculiar mechanism of action at a distance, which prevents the wave continuously distributed in space from producing an action in two places on the screen. And then he says, "In my opinion, one can remove this objection only in the following way, that one does not describe the process solely by the Schrödinger wave, but that at the same time one localizes the particle during the propagation." So what he's suggesting is that we shouldn't have a wave function monism. The wave function shouldn't be regarded as everything there is. We should think of there actually be a localized particle. I think that Monsieur de Broglie is right to search in this direction. So he's sympathetic to it, even if he didn't regard the theory that de Broglie presented the Solvay Conference as a candidate for the final story. Some of you know that Einstein himself worked on a theory along similar lines and prepared an article for publication and then withdrew it because he became, it wasn't quite the de Broglie-Bohm theory, but it was very similar. And it had the non-locality of the de Broglie-Bohm theory. And once Einstein realized that, he withdrew the paper. But it's there in the archives, and it's since been published. So he says, one works solely with a Schrödinger wave's interpretation of psi squared implies, to my mind, a contradiction with the postulate of relativity. And I think there he's assuming that if I, you know, psi is something like an ordinary field, if I attribute a value of psi to a region of space-time, that's supposed to be a local intrinsic property of that point. Okay. And there's a sort of simplification of this argument that occurs in letters to certain people, which has been known as his box argument, is, you know, imagine you've got, you know, a particle that's, you know, in a box, then you divide the box in half, and you send one half off to Tokyo. And the state of the particle is, you know, superposition of being in box one and box two. And then, you know, you're in Tokyo, you open the box, you know, box two, you find the particle's not there, and then what you standard thing to do is now collapse the state and say it's B1. But this can reasonably signify only one thing. The particle was already in Paris in box B1 prior to the drainage experiment made in Tokyo in box two, B2. Every other interpretation is absurd. This is from a letter to de Broglie. How can we imagine that the simple fact of having observed nothing in Tokyo has been able to promote the localization of the particle at a distance of many thousand miles away? And a lot of people have thought of this kind of argument as being very different from the later EPR-type arguments and the later versions of Einstein's own argument. Obviously, this is very similar to the argument that was given in 1927. Now, you know, you've just got the boxes rather than two locations on the screen. But I think if you think of the wave function the way I'm recommending, oh, and the reason this is regarded as a very different argument is those are about entanglement and this isn't. There's only one particle, so how the heck can there be any entanglement? Well, I think if you think of wave functions the way I'm recommending that, and that it's just simply not true that this should not be regarded as an entangled state. It's just a matter of fact that entangled or not is relative to a decomposition of a system into subsystems. And we can treat this, you know, as a one-particle wave function. There's only one system, but we can also say, well, no, there's two subsystems. There's a state of affairs in the box, and there's this, you know, in box one, the state of affairs in box two. And say, let's just have a space that's spanned by states that have n particles in box one and m particles in box two. Notice that space includes, you know, states in which you open both boxes and find particles in both boxes. And the states in which there's exactly one particle are a special class of states. This is just a rewriting of B1, and that's a rewriting of B2. And if I write it that way, decomposition of systems into these box states, well, that is a state in which the states of those two boxes are entangled. And in fact, it's looking an awful lot like the familiar presentations of the EPR argument. So I actually think, and this isn't new to me. There's a couple people who've pointed out that there actually is continuity back all the way back to 1927 in what Einstein is talking about, and we should think of the discussions in 1927 and the box arguments as precursors to the EPR argument and Einstein's later arguments. And in particular, there's two very nice expositions of this, one by Travis Norson, published in the American Journal of Physics 2005, and a more recent one by John Norton. And that's the end of my talk. Maybe we should give, like, you know, people who don't see me every day first priority. Well, Morgan, that counts as you.
I assume you've asked Tim Maudlin what he thinks of this idea that we should give up convenience, supervenience, and consider the possibility of the way it functions like a non-local vehicle. And I see how going that route would address his concern about this, you know, this fact of seemingly three or four dimensional experience and this n dimensional configuration space. I'm wondering, what does he say when you bring up this possibility of addressing his concern?
Yeah, right. I just want to say, unlike Barry and David, Tim isn't a big fan of human supervenience. You know, Barry wants to save human supervenience by saying that the space in which we define things is configuration space, and you know, Tim would say, well, you know, that's just nuts, and we know the space we live in is four dimensional space time, and for that reason we shouldn't be wave function monists, right? The genesis of this paper, as I mentioned, comes from that Oxford conference. And Tim gave this paper was a wave function. And I said during the discussion, well, you know, suppose you think of it this way. And I very briefly sketched what I just said here. You know, would that alleviate your worries? I think it's actually in the published discussion. My memory is that he said, yeah, that could alleviate those worries. But it's taken me, you know, this long to get around to actually explicitly writing it out. I was originally hoping when I submitted this paper to PSA that Tim would be there, but I suspect he's not coming all the way from Abu Dhabi just to go to this conference because he's not on the program. So I suspect he's not going to be there. So I would hope that if I said this to Tim, he would say, okay, yeah, that's fine. But what I'll do is when I get a revision of the paper that I'm happy with, I'll send it to him and see what he says. David Albert, I think I've talked about this with him, and I just don't. We start from such very different places because he really is in love with this idea that he calls the marvelous point, the idea that all there is this point. You know, the world is just a single point moving around in a high dimensional configuration space. And then it becomes a challenge to explain why it seems to us that there are objects in three-dimensional space. And you try to extract a preferred division of this big three-n-dimensional space into three-dimensional spaces by looking at the Hamiltonian and saying that we want, you know, a three-dimensional space or a space in which the Hamiltonian acts locally, and you know, it's this sort of project that he has of understanding things that way. It seems to me fundamentally misguided. Yeah, listen.
I wrote a paper a number of years ago on this sort of Einstein, so showing that it was equivalent to the this later EPR argument.
Oh, good. I have to add that to my citation list.
Yeah, I think Anthony references it in his book, The Guido of Anthony.
Okay, all right, good.
But you see, the key point there seemed to be to take this. So there's a point that Michael Redhead makes in his book, mm-hmm. where he says if you look at the standard EPR argument, mm-hmm. then they have two different measurements at one side. They can say one or the other,
right.
Two measurements, to induce
okay.
one or the other of two states over here.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael says, well, you don't need two measurements. It's sufficient to consider one, because you can either consider making that measurement or not making that measurement.
Mm-hmm.
If you make this measurement, say, along the x direction,
mm-hmm.
here it claps
mm-hmm.
past on the other side
right.
to the x.
Right.
Or if you don't, and now you've changed the sort of, you know,
mm-hmm.
you run exactly the EPR argument
as
per usual.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's interesting in the context
right.
of the 1935 argument. But
sort
of more essential here, because here you only really have one measurement easily accessible to you to either look and see the particle is there or not.
Right. Yeah.
But the basic logical structure of the argument is pretty much the same.
I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah. John Norton in his paper, you know, if all I have to, you know, if all I have is, you know, look in the box or not, then. You know, there's not enough there to like get anything like a Bell inequality or something
no.
like that. But but since you know this state is a state in which you know if you could measure arbitrary observables on the state is when where you could get you know, Bell inequality violations.
Oh, you could crisply or not.
Yeah,
Bell,
right.
Bell.
And John actually makes a suggestion about how you would realize some that sort of thing.
Right. There's been a lot of talk about that as well, like non-locality of a single photon, it's called.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Asher Perez,
mm-hmm.
well, there's the original non-locality of a single photon paper by Tan, Walls, and Collins, where they
mm-hmm.
consider local homodyming
mm-hmm.
measurements, and there's some problems with that. And then I wrote a paper on non-locality of a single photon, and Asher Perez
mm-hmm.
did.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of discussion of that issue
yeah.
in the literature. The other place where this, I'm not sure who the first person to discuss the basic similarity between a 1927 argument and 1935 one was, but it's worth looking into. Harvey Brown wrote something in Portuguese when he lived in Brazil.
Oh, did he really?
And which he mentioned to me once. Yeah, and so that might well be the first example of such an argument. So it's worth
okay, good. I'll look for that.
So you'd have to
yeah.
email him, of course, because I don't know how to find
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah. Good. Mike has hand up first, then during.
Okay, move on to part. Sorry, go ahead, Mike.
I think you're
okay.
Oh, that's
cool.
It.
Okay. Anyways, but just probably be short. So, near the beginning, you mentioned something about we shouldn't consider make ontological claims about theory unless we first. Try to view them as arriving from more fundamental
theory. That makes it sound like first we have to have a more fundamental theory. But what I wanted to say is that
my question relates to that.
Yeah.
Can you put your maxim back up?
Yeah,
here?
We should operate excess. Appropriate caution. And be at least open to the idea that the theory is not fundamental or approximation to some deeper theory.
Okay, so my question is...
not clear to me that without that theory in mind, that whether that maxim has bite or not, but I think it does.
So maybe you already answered it.
Right.
So my question is, like, how sweeping is this? Do we need an existing theory? Like, is it still the case? Would it still be the case if we didn't have a deeper... Would we need to just always be open to the fact that there may be an underlying theory? Or
I think we should always be open to the fact that there may be an underlying theory. And you might say, well, how can this maxim be put into place when I don't have that situation in hand? And what I want to say is that you can respect the maxim if you refrain from saying things that your theory need not commit you to. So here's an example of how someone in the 19th century might have applied that axiom. So suppose you got evidence from Dalton that chemical elements combine in fixed ratios in a chemical reaction, and you get some evidence that from the kinetic theory of gases that the gases are composed of molecules bouncing around, and you might say, okay, great. Yay, Democritus, there are ultimate individual atoms. Well, I don't think you should commit yourself to whether those atoms are further divisible or not. What you should say is, well, there are bits of matter that get transmitted undivided in chemical reactions and remain intact when in a gas typically bouncing around. And not commit yourself to any deeper theory about the structure of those atoms. Don't say more about the structure of the atoms until. So the point is, your theory does not require the atoms to have to be further divisible. But it would be a mistake to say the lesson of my theory is that atoms are indivisible.
So. Could I follow up on that?
Yeah.
So is this guiding principle something for philosophers of science to use or for
Everybody. Actual
scientists to use as well?
Anyone
sometimes scientists actually go beyond the evidence and hypothesize and, say, okay, well, I can't conclude that there really are these indivisible atoms, for example, but suppose that I assume that there are such things, maybe I can design some experiments based on that hypothesis.
That's fine.
Yeah. So
but the success of that hypothesis, if it doesn't require those things to be, Democritian indivisibles, should not lead you to a commitment to that. So, there's all sorts of attitudes. This is something that I think philosophers are very bad at. Is philosophers tend to talk about attitudes towards theories which are accepted or don't, or how strongly do you believe in the theory. Well, there's lots of attitudes that you can have towards your theories and hypotheses, and one attitude is that for certain purposes, treating something like this is getting the salient features right. A good example of that is Einstein in 1905 in the light quanta paper. What he argues for is the conclusion that under conditions of low density, light acts for thermodynamic purposes as if it consists of a discrete particles of energy, and that's for these purposes, light acts as acts like this, and I think that caution was warranted because of course he also knew that for certain other purposes, light acted as a wave, he didn't say more than he had actually argued for. And that's not the same as not making amplitude inferences that go beyond the evidence, because that wasn't deduced from the evidence. That's not just a mere resummary of the evidence, but it's what he had good evidence for. This is what he had argued for.
Yeah. So, suppose we accept it, say, we don't have to worry about the magical configuration space, it's kind of many dimensions. We're fine in three dimensions because we have field theory that explains those localized particle states. Now, someone might then say, okay, but the real world doesn't exist of one scalar field. It might have several fields, and they can be entangled with each other. And the real way to think about it would be the configuration of the field configuration space, which is infinitely dimensional and complicated, and somehow we can only think of it in strange ways. But would then the argument be, well, that means we shouldn't commit to that, because maybe there's more fundamental theory, but all the different fields themselves are kind of
I understand what you're saying.
Yep. Like a single super field.
Right. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I want to say a couple things, because I mean, this was a move that sort of anticipates that someone like Tim Modlin or David Albert might make. Is okay, instead of a finite micro configuration space, you've got a space of field connections, which is, you know, really, you know, this space your theory is defined is on this big infinite dimensional space. And I want to say, well, yes, there is this big interdimensional space, and that is the quantum state space of our theory, of our quantum field theory. But nonetheless, you know, even if I have different fields and different field types and I have interacting fields, I still want to be able to talk about, defining those in terms of local field operators. And yeah, there can be states in which you've got all kinds of complicated entanglement. So what I want to say is that if I'm going to take my, if we're going to be a realist about quantum states, then the state space of my theory is, you know, you've got this algebra of observables, and you've got that the whole big complicated states quantum space of all states on those, and that's, you know, for a field theory not going to be, it's not going to be for many quantum theories, it's not going to be a finite dimensional space. That's my quantum state space, but I don't have to say that. You know, this is a state space of observables defined on space-time, right? And so I'm not getting worried about things getting unstuck from space-time. And for simplicity, I consider you've just got, you know, this single field. I don't think that, I mean, things get more complicated. I think things get more complicated if I have different kinds of fields. But I think that essentially the same kind of lessons are going to about if
they
take more
complicated thing. Yeah, just thinking about your maxim here, and you were hoping that you weren't prevented from doing ontology when you didn't have your deeper theory. But thinking about the argument you then went on to give, it depended on doing a particular type of approximation, right? So there are a number of different approximation moves you had to do in order to get back to the non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So it seems like a response to this would be, well, by the time you have your deeper theory, right, you can make all these approximating moves and get back to the non-relativistic quantum mechanics, but why not just deal with the full-fledged, I mean, this is a very interesting question, why not just deal with the full-fledged quantum field theory that's fully relativistic and doesn't have localizable particles and et cetera, et cetera. Doesn't admit these hyperplane, where you don't want to use the hyperplane dependent representations.
So in one response to David Albert might be, okay, well, this is metaphysics of, it's not just elementary quantum metaphysics, it's physics of elementary quantum mechanics, because this is physics of quantum mechanics where you've got actually a finite dimensional configuration space. You're going to say, David, you know, why are you drawing metaphysical conclusions from quantum mechanics rather than quantum field theory? I think it's a fair enough point. I still think that but here's what I want to say, is that, well, why do we use quantum mechanics at all? Why do we use classical mechanics at all? I don't think that we've thrown them out. We use them when they're more appropriate. We use quantum mechanics when relativistic effects and can be ignored, and we could ignore, we're low energy, so we can more ignore particle creation. And it's useful, and it is actually is getting something right, as is classical mechanics getting something right. So I think that just because classical mechanics has been superseded, that doesn't mean the project of making sense of the classical mechanics has been thrown out the window. But I do think that we have to think of the project of making sense of classical mechanics in light of this maxim. And in particular, you know, Richard Healy's book, Gauging What's Real, is about how to interpret classical electrodynamics. How should we think of the ontology of the of classical electrodynamics? But the question is, how do we think of the ontology of classical electrodynamics in light of things like the Aharonov-Bohm effect? It is classical theories that he's interpreting, but he's interpreting them in the light of quantum theories. And I think that's what we should be thinking. Well, we haven't thrown away classical theories. We haven't thrown away quantum mechanics. They're saying something about the world, and they're saying something about something that's right about the world. And we should think of what they're saying about the world in a way that's consistent with them not being fundamental theories. And I would say the same thing about our own current physical theory, best theories, whatever we got.
And sure, yes, there's also the problem of what you do with the quantum field theory if you don't have a starting point in a previous theory to interpret it. But so here's maybe a follow-up question is, given that the conclusions you were drawing about the, in particular about the wave function being being non-local, right, not ascribing properties to local points of space-time, depended on having that particular series of approximations you made to get to the Schrodinger equation, right?
I could have taken other routes, and I would have had.
So this is what I'm wondering:
is
other ways? I mean, when you could have gone Galilean quantum field theory, for example, I mean, that would be another way of trying to.
That's essentially what I did. Yeah.
Except the Newton-Wigner representation it presupposes the.
But
plane dependent, right?
What's that? So. I went from a relativistic quantum theory to a Galilean quantum field theory by taking those Newton-Wigner operators, which are defined in the relativistic context, but defined in such a way that explicitly breaks covariance. And I mean, I think that's one way to get a Galilean theory out of a relativistic theory. Break covariance, pick a reference frame, and then take the C infinity that goes to infinity limit. So that's basically the picture that I was briefly sketching. There's other routes, but I think a case could be made that all those other routes are going to come to the same kind of picture of the wave function, because if I have a one particle wave function, by quantum field theory, the general state space is, put particle detectors all over the place, any number of them can fire. And if I'm going to get a theory of n particles, I'm going to have to restrict myself to n particle states, and that's going to be a global restriction on the state. So I don't think the conclusions depend on the particular route I took. They better not. Yeah.
This is maybe more of a remark in terms of the sort of maxims we shouldn't make premature conclusions. If you look at say general relativity,
right?
Now we know it kind of find a theory because we expect it to be some kind of quantum gravity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yet most people would, if it's on a textbook, it would say, well, it interprets like the curvature of space, like space bends.
Mm-hmm.
But some people don't argue that. For example, Harvey Brown thinks as it's dynamical, it's all not space-time itself. And I think Steven Weinberg kind of subtly makes this point that it acts if it was geometrical, but it isn't really, it's just all dynamics. And there, I mean, again, maybe we shouldn't make any such conclusion, but wait for the more fundamental theory. Would that be kind of parallel?
That would be sort of in the spirit of what I'm saying, though. The thing with Harvey is you have to be clear about what you mean when space-time is curved. And I think Harvey's main point is that we can't divorce talk about space-time from talk about the dynamics of things in space-time, and I actually think that that's right. Yeah.
So this going back to this maxim again, seems that there are some sorts of conclusions you might be able to draw from physical theories that will survive some that you can't. It'd be interesting to think about what the differences are. So a sort of conclusion that would survive would be, say, that quantum theory is non-local, according to Bell's theorem. And so it falls under this category of experimental metaphysics that Shimoni talks about.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a conclusion that might not survive is that the wave function evolves unitarily, which is something that the whole many worlds interpretation is
mm-hmm.
sort of based upon.
Mm-hmm.
And will hopefully go away once a more fundamental theory comes along. So it seems that it'd be interesting to explore that question.
Actually, that's thank you for that. That's a good point, because you reminded me of an occasion in which I applied my maxim, and I don't really think I realized until this moment that it was doing it. Because at the end of the Many Worlds Conference that was here in 2007, there's this round table. And Simon Saunders asked me, after all this, why are you still not never ever at it? Because it pains him. It pains him that I haven't gone over. I haven't seen the light yet. It's just so obvious to him. This is the right way to think about it. And what I said is, well, look. Because I'd given this talk based on the work I did with Hilary Greaves, which was aimed at addressing one line of worries about to Everett theory, and I said, well, if all that succeeds, then what it does is get Everett on the table as an option. And now, if you're going to ask me to believe in all these branches of the wave functions, that they're there and they have, and then you're extrapolating the unitary evolution of the wave function way beyond what we have good evidence for, and I think we should be a little bit cautious about that. We should be open to the possibility that something else happens in other regions. So I didn't think of it until just now, but I think that's an instance of that maxim. So quantum mechanics as we have it, has wave functions evolving unitarily? Do we say, well, if I'm going to interpret quantum mechanics, I have to make sense of that? Well, we'd be more cautious about how far that unitary evolution goes. Yeah. I'm sorry, Eric's been waiting forever.
Oh, no, you actually more or less answered it during second.
Okay.
During swallow.
Okay. Okay. Ryan?
So I think you have answered it. I wondered, what I've been wondering is whether another argumentative path is possible. So suppose we are at a stage of physics where we didn't yet have quantum field theory. We could still read the three opening quotes by Albert Lohr and Madlen and think them nuts. And I wondered if there's some way we could arrive at the sort of wave function monism that you want in that situation.
So imagine we haven't got a quantum field theory yet, and you've got people saying things like that, and I think they're nuts. That's a very good question, whether there would be another argumentative strategy. I would find it harder to make a good case that they're nuts.
I like the moves that you do, going to the, taking the recovery that you've sketched. I like that, but I wonder whether there's another path.
That's a good question. I mean, part of my motivation for writing this paper was, you know, discussions with these guys. I guess it sort of like went nowhere, and you're trying to explain to them why I think I have a principled reason for thinking they're nuts rather than just, because, you know, you don't want to say to David Allen, you know, that's just too darn weird, I can't accept that. Because, well, we have pretty good evidence that the world's weird in some ways. The question is, which ways is it weird?
So on that, it seems that like if you're sticking within standard sort of quantum theory, mm-hmm. thinking about quantum field theory, the sort of reason that we see this three-dimensional space, even though the wave function lives in configuration space, has to do with the Hamiltonian being local
mm-hmm.
with respect to that three-dimensional
right,
space.
Yeah.
And one probably could explore that as being a residue of some fact about quantum field theory, but one could just take it as a fact of
it. Yeah, that effect is pretty much David Albert's strategy, is to start with configuration space and say, well, look, and say, well, here's the Hamiltonian,
mm-hmm.
and it's local in three-dimensional space, and this is why, this is why I think, even though it makes no sense to talk about proximity of my hand to this table, that's why I think it makes sense, because the way my hand and the table interact. Yeah. So he does actually take as a serious project to explain the illusion. Yeah, and that's the way he's thinking.
That's what he does.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's thank him again.